And we are. We're down at Vintage today on the fly, kicking off a what we're hoping is going to be a phenomenal week at AirVenture Oshkosh 2016. And for our last segment, I'm joined by Andrew King. And Andrew is, I've had the pleasure of interviewing Andrew a number of times, all for all kinds of exciting, cool stuff over the years. And this year doesn't disappoint either. And you're involved in this new World War One reenactment thing they're doing down at Vintage, not at Warbirds, but in Vintage. Tell us a little bit about the program, how it started, and what you guys are doing.
Well, I think basically it was because it's the 100th anniversary of the American involvement in World War One. 1916 was the year the Lafayette Escadrille started, which a lot of people know the story of the Lafayette Escadrille, a group of American pilots who volunteered to fly and fight for the French against
cool
the
movie.
Germans. And
yeah.
And there's been a couple of cool movies about it. Yeah,
yeah.
I had to help. I managed to help with one of them. But
yep. I remember that we covered that.
Right, right. Yeah. But so it's basically the 100th anniversary of American involvement in World War One, as far as the flying part of it. And so there was a group that got together with the idea that it would be commemorated at Oshkosh. And as I say, Rick Larson was kind of the spearhead of it, and Hal Bryan
he's
and Chris Henry. And,
he's one of the EAA
right, people at EAA headquarters here that were involved. And I guess I have a little bit of a name as far as World War One aviation
yeah,
and,
Andrew,
and history and replicas and things. So they asked
me. It's like your whole life.
Well, it's I grew up at the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome in upstate New York, of course, where there are World War One air shows every weekend all summer. And so I know a lot of the, such as it is, World War One community. And I got involved helping out and approaching the different owners of World War One replica aircraft and asked them to come to Oshkosh and getting in on the conference calls and trying to figure out where to put them and what to do. And we've got some neat ideas that we came up with. For instance, they're going to fly at 7 o'clock in the morning a couple times this week and 8 o'clock in the evening, so kind of dawn patrol and dusk patrol, very World War One-ish type of stuff.
Yep.
And the best time for some of these airplanes to fly, because it's usually calmer early in the morning and late in the evening, and it's just kind of a traditional antique airplane World War One type of thing to fly at dawn, so that'll be neat.
So educate the listeners a little bit. Specifically, what kind of airplane did the American side use in the World War One era?
Well, the Lafayette Escadrille started out with Newport. They were sesquiplane, which means the lower wings are a lot smaller than the upper wings. But that's what the Lafayette Escadrille started out with. They eventually went to Spads. And the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome is bringing a Spad. I think they're going to be here tomorrow with the Spad and then be here the rest of the week. So Spads were probably the most common French airplane during World War One. And so we will have an example of one of those here.
And these are all flying examples, right?
These are flying replicas, yeah. There'll be, I think, five flying replicas. Right behind us is Kermit's Albatross D5 replica, which unfortunately they discovered just before they brought it up here that the fabric was starting to go bad on it, so they won't be able to fly it. But the Golden Age Air Museum in Bethel, Pennsylvania is here. They have their Fokker triplane, which has an original 80 Lerone rotary engine in it, which is a fascinating thing in itself. And they have a Sopwith Pup replica here that has a more modern Lycoming engine. And it's a little more practical, but it's externally authentic. It still has the wooden wings, and still it's very close in looks and in probably flying characteristics to a Sopwith Pup. And then Rhinebeck is bringing the Spad, and they're also bringing a Fokker D8, which has, again, a rotary engine, a World War One era rotary engine on it. And there'll be, I think we have three different types of rotary engines here. The 80 Lerone that's in the Fokker triplane, the 160 Gnome that's in the Fokker D8 from Rhinebeck, and then Tom Kozura is over here to our right at the Vintage Circle here with a Clerget engine, 130 horsepower Clerget engine.
Yeah, people were asking me what this was.
Right.
I had no idea.
It goes in a Sopwith Camel. He's building a Sopwith Camel for it. Unfortunately, it's not done yet, but it's a beautiful engine, makes a terrific sound, and he's running it, I think, every day during AirVenture.
Well, and from what I understand, they're going to run all those airplanes.
Right, and I heard them running the Fokker triplane before with the rotary engine. Kermit ran the Albatross here earlier today, and Tom ran his Clerget earlier today. So I think every day we'll have some original World War One engines running.
Now, you're very comfortable in and around and flying these old airplanes, but tell our listeners, there are some things that are unique to this. I mean, these are old vintage airplanes, but that does not mean that they're easier to operate than a modern Cessna, for example.
Right. Yeah, people sometimes look at them and think, oh, they're simple, they must be easy, but it doesn't equate that way. And some of them are. The Fokker D8 is sort of a modern airplane. It's a cantilever monoplane. It has fairly good moment arms. It's actually a fairly good flying airplane. The British SE-5 is a fairly good flying airplane, has lots of dihedral. I was talking to Kermit about flying the Albatross. It sounds like it's kind of a typical old airplane, kind of heavy on the ailerons. A lot of them are tail heavy. You have to hold forward pressure. The Fokker triplane is a little bit at the other end of the extreme. And I think the theory behind the Fokker triplane was that they knew that the more unstable an airplane was, the more maneuverable it is. And so I think Anthony Fokker and his team designed it to be unstable. It has very short moment arms. It has no vertical fin, only the rudder, so it's very quick in yaw. Very large elevators, so again, very quick in pitch. And also the Fokker triplane. The hardest thing about the Fokker triplane is landing and taking off, because if you go look at it, and you can see that when you're sitting in the pilot seat, the middle wing basically blocks the entire world out. So with the tail down, you can't see anything except for there's two little cutouts in the trailing edge, and you can see about 15 feet in front of you at about a 30-degree angle. So taking off and landing is tricky, but it has no dihedral. So it's very unstable in yaw. Again, short moment arms, it's kind of unstable in pitch. It's hard to believe it was a good gun platform, but it also would have been very hard to hit when you were attacking a Fokker triplane. So it's kind of the other extreme as far as difficult to fly. But a lot of the airplanes, it's kind of typical of World War I airplanes to be heavy on the ailerons. They hadn't figured out the slotted type ailerons. They had plane hinges. A lot of times they were tail heavy. Like a lot of old airplanes, that kind of encompasses most of them. But
a lot of the later Barnstormers also, they didn't figure that out for a while.
Right up until the 30s, really, when they really started about 1931 or 32, they started to figure out how to make airplanes fly nicely and have light control pressures and effective ailerons and things. And so, as I say, the Fokker D8, the Fokker D7 is a pretty nice flying airplane, and the SE-5, there's a lot of them in the middle. The SPAD is very unstable also. You really have to fly it all the time. But it was a good dogfighter.
What's your favorite airplane to fly of that era?
That's a good question. I think probably the Fokker D7 or the Fokker D8, probably either one of those. Again, they're fairly advanced. Both of them are cantilever wings. The D7 is a biplane, but cantilever wings, very advanced design, a steel tube fuselage. It was not out of place in 1927, 1928 still, where most World War I types were obsolete by the end of the war. So probably the Fokker D7.
From an operational standpoint, let's talk about just some operational things. Like when you go to pre-flight this airplane, it's not a Cessna 150. What are you looking for? And then let's get in it. Let's start it. What do you do? What's the process?
Well, most of them, of course, have a lot of rigging wires that have to be checked to make sure they're secure and they haven't loosened up or anything.
Because they don't have struts.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Or just the wing struts, but with the bracing wires. And operationally, I mean, the pre-flight is, I mean, there's some of the same kind of things to check, just more of them. A lot of the engines have to have the rocker arms for the valves greased before every flight or oiled before every flight. A lot of them in World War I, which we don't do so much anymore, they didn't have fuel pumps on the engine. They had an air pump that pressurized the tank and pushed the fuel up to the engine. So you had to get in. They had like a bicycle pump actually in the cockpit that you had to pump the bicycle pump to pump up pressure. And one of the problems with that was if a bullet went through your tank, ooh. Yeah, it tried to spray fuel all over the place. So that was bad. And most of the modern replicas use fuel pumps. But I think Kermit's Albatross, I believe, has an air pump on it and an air pressure system. And then, of course, the ground handling. World War I airplanes did not have brakes. They all had tail skids. And so there was a little bit more of a trick to taxiing and getting them to go where you wanted them to go. A lot of times they had big, wide grass runways, so that helped a lot with that. But they tried to operate them on a modern airport like this.
That tail-heavy thing might actually have been the brakes.
Yes, well, it does help to drag the tail more, although the further behind the main wheels that the center of gravity is, the more likely they are to ground loop. It makes them less stable as far as rolling on the ground.
Well, they ground looped a lot of them.
They did ground loop a lot of them, especially the Fokker triplanes were known. They supposedly only gave the Fokker triplanes to the best pilots just because they were better at landing and taking off, not necessarily because they were better in combat. But here we've got about a 1,400-foot runway laid out between the north-south main runway 1836 and the taxiway on the west side. And so it's the wind really is going to have to be pretty much down the runway for them to be able to fly.
So let's recap. If people want to see the airplanes fly, they need to go down here. Do you know a row number or what area is it?
Roughly even with the ultralight runway.
Okay.
And it's, as I say, it's on the west side of the main runway, but roughly even with the ultralight runway as far as north and south.
So if people walk out through Vintage Parking to the ropes, you're going to be right there.
That's right. You'll be right in front of them, right? And we'll be hand-propping the airplanes. Pretty much all the airplanes have to be hand-propped, just like they were in 1918. And there'll be people on the wingtips helping them steer when they're taxiing, and a little bit of a glimpse into the operation of World War I airplanes. And fascinating sounds. And if you really want to notice something, the smell of the rotary engines, because they use castor oil, and the smell of burned castor oil is a very unique smell. So that's something to look for, too.
That is very cool. You know, it's kind of a neat thing that you're doing here with that. Is it going to continue, or is this just a one-year thing?
Well, they wanted to try it this year. The World War I started in 1914, and then the Americans got involved in 1916, so this is the 100th anniversary of that. 1918 will be the 100th anniversary of the end of the war, and so they're hoping to build on this event and do another centennial event in 2018 for the 100th anniversary of the end of the war.
So we're going to keep them timed so that they're more special and more meaningful.
That's right. Yep. So two more years, we should have another similar event and hopefully even get more airplanes here.
Oh, that's great. Well, Andrew, congratulations on your work on helping to put all this together, and something that everyone's going to enjoy. The times again, just one more time, repeat the times for the flying.
I believe tonight is going to be 8 o'clock p.m. tonight, and then 7 in the morning tomorrow, and then I think 8 p.m. on Thursday, and 7 a.m. on Saturday.
Great.
I believe are the times.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us on
you're welcome, Jeff.
EA Radio. So, Jay Munchie, we are on the fly, and that's going to wrap up our segment for today. Tomorrow, we continue at 1 o'clock with some other exciting stuff. And we're just going to make our way over to KidVenture tomorrow. So that should be fun, and the Air Academy. Jay Munchie, have a great afternoon. You're listening to EAA Radio.